stress and deal with it through a process of self-destruction. You're irresponsible, resentful, manipulative, hostile, and have a psychological predisposition to addiction. I laugh. It's not funny, James. Keep going. This is not a joke. It's easier to laugh. Now keep going. She looks down at the file. You are also very, very angry. Incredibly angry. She looks at me. You are also very intelligent. I take a sip of my coffee.
Sounds about right.
Does it?
Except for the intelligence part.
Why do you say that?
If I was very intelligent, I probably wouldn't be so fucked up.
Addicts, as a group, generally score far above average on intelligence tests.
Why?
You tell me.
I guess maybe we're smart enough to have figured out how shitty things are, and we decide addiction is the only way to deal with it.
You acknowledge that you're an addict. I laugh again.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure you would.
I do.
Good. That's the first step toward getting better.
If it's one of the 12, then it's the only one I'm taking.
You're getting angry.
Yeah.
Why?
Right now I'm getting angry thinking about the impossibility of ever getting better.
Is that all you're angry about?
No.
What else?
Pretty much fucking everything. She laughs.
Everything?
I smile. Sounds stupid, but it's true. I'm angry about pretty much everything.
How long have you felt that way?
Forever.
As a child?
My first memories are of anger and pain.
That's too bad.
It's the way things are.
I think if we can work toward finding the source of your anger, we'll be a long ways toward solving a number of your issues. The only way to get to your anger is to control your addictions. And the only way, I truly believe, you'll be able to control your addictions is by working the 12 steps.
Not happening.
She takes a deep breath, leans back.
I light another cigarette.
Do you know the success rate of this hospital?
No.
It's about 17%. That's of patients who are sober for a year after they leave here.
That sucks.
That's the best success rate of any treatment center in the world.
That really sucks.
I've worked in 6. I'm an alcoholic and an addict myself, and the only thing I've ever seen that works is the 12 steps.
You don't seem like an alcoholic or an addict.
Everyone that works here is, even the janitors and the dishwashers. That way, if you need help, everywhere you turn there are people who can help you.
That's comforting.
It's supposed to be. How long have you been sober? 16 years.
Long time.
You can have that too. You just have to do what we tell you and trust us, even if you think it's ridiculous.
If it involves the number 12, it's not gonna happen.
It's the only way, James. The only way.
I'm gonna be honest with you about something.
I would appreciate that.
I walked out of here 2 nights ago.
Where were you going?
I was gonna go find some shit and kill myself.
Why didn't you?
You know Leonard?
I know of him.
Leonard stopped me.
That surprises me.
Why?
That's a separate issue.
What?
We'll talk about it some other time.
There might not be another time.
You're serious?
Yeah.
Do you really want to die?
I know I can't keep living the way I've been living, and I know I won't ever believe in the 12 steps. People like you keep saying it's the only way, so I'm thinking that I might as well just put myself out of my misery now and save myself and my family the pain of the future.
Do you really want to die?
I fucking hate myself. I'm sick of it.
Why are you still here?
I promised Leonard I'd stay for 24 hours. Then my brother and a couple of old friends showed up for visiting hours. I ended up having a good day, the best day I can really remember having for a long time. And when the 24 hours were up, I was too tired and too happy to think about killing myself.
You can have more days like that.
Not if I can't stay sober.
You can stay sober.
Not if your way is the only way.
It is, and you can do it.
I shake my head. Nope. She leans back in her chair and she lights another cigarette and she stares at me. I stare back. She speaks.
You have two decisions to make, James. The first is whether you want to live, and I believe you do. I believe that deep inside of you, you realize what a horrible waste it would be to kill yourself. I believe that what you present to the world and what you are on the inside are two different things, and that you know that what you are on the inside is something that's worth saving. The second decision is whether you're willing to do what it takes, and what we tell you it takes, to get sober. You need to decide whether you're going to stop being stubborn and whether you're willing to open your mind to something that you really don't know anything about. Take your time and think. As we both know, you are a very intelligent young man. If you have any questions, come see me. If you decide the answer to your decisions is yes, come see me. If your answer is no, I'm sorry, and good luck to you. She stares at me. I stare back. I have a question.
What?
Why didn't you guys throw me out of here after I attacked Roy?
She takes a drag.
Lincoln and Ken wanted to throw you out. I hadn't met you, but I'm good friends with Hank. When Hank heard what had happened, he came to me and told me that the person who attacked Roy was not the person he knew. He said the person he knew was kind and gentle and quiet and shy and was the strongest and bravest person he'd ever seen. I trust Hank, and I fought to keep you here because he told me I should.
I like Hank.
He likes you.
Your friends?
We hunt and fish together, play cards. He's sort of my boyfriend.
I laugh. Tell him I said hi, and that I'm taking good care of his coat.
He'll be glad to hear it.
We done?
I hope not.
I stand. We'll see.
She stands, hands me a card. That has my home phone number on it. If I'm not here and you need me, call.
What if you're at Hank's house?
He sleeps at my house.
I laugh.
Thanks.
I walk to the door, and I walk out, and I close the door behind me. I walk through the bright halls and back to the unit. As I enter the upper level, I see most of the men have gathered on the lower level. They are sitting on the couches and the chairs, and the bald man is sitting on a chair in front of them. He's speaking, and Lincoln is standing off to the side, watching him. I walk down and I sit on the floor. I am near enough to hear, but far enough away so that I'm still alone.
My worst experience, and the one that I want to share with you, was the one that made me finally decide to come here.
He looks down, takes a deep breath.
I'm from Toledo. 2 years ago on Halloween, a little girl in our neighborhood was kidnapped and killed by a man in a lion costume. It really shook everyone up, so to try and prevent it, our neighborhood council moved Halloween to October 1st, the thinking being that we could control things more and prevent another tragedy. My two little girls, Laura, who is 6, and Jennifer, who is 9, love Halloween. They're real dramatic kids, and Halloween is their favorite holiday. And every year they both get dressed up like Princess Leia, and I get dressed up like Luke Skywalker. I put them in the back of a wagon, and I pull them from house to house, and we pretend that they're riding in the Millennium Falcon, and that I'm piloting it.
He stops, and he looks at Lincoln. Lincoln nods, and he holds up a fist as a sign of strength. The bald man returns the nod, and he looks back at us.
A couple months ago, I made a deal with my wife, whose name is Terry, to stop drinking. Part of the deal was that I could drink non-alcoholic beer when I really felt like I needed something. Being me, I went out and bought 20 cases of the stuff, hid 19 of them, and kept one in the garage refrigerator. I have trouble sleeping, and I can't sleep without drinking, but I found if I drank 15 non-alcoholics a night, I got enough in me to put me to sleep.
He takes a deep breath.
So every night for 6 weeks I ran out to the garage during commercial breaks on the TV, and I slammed non-alcoholic beers so I could sleep. It sounds dumb, but you do what you do, and you do what you need to do, and that's what I did. A couple of men laugh. Lincoln gives them a hard look. They stop. The problem with my plan was that because I was drinking fake beer every night, I never stopped wanting to drink real beer, and if anything, the fake stuff made me want to drink the real stuff even more. He stops, looks at the floor. As he speaks, his voice cracks. Now it starts getting tough. Lincoln speaks. You're doing great. Just keep going. The bald man looks at him, nods, and looks back at us. So, my wife had to go to New Jersey for her niece Tina's bat mitzvah. We would normally go to something like that as a family, but the bat mitzvah was on the morning after our neighborhood Halloween. So me and Terry decided that I would stay home and do Halloween with the girls, and Terry would go to Tina's bat mitzvah. A tear starts running down his cheek. I took Terry to the airport, and I promised her I wouldn't drink. As soon as she was on the plane, I went straight to the airport lounge, and I ordered a vodka and cranberry. He stops, wipes his face. From there I went to the liquor store and bought a fifth and some more cranberry, and I drank the whole way home. He wipes his face. Then I snuck into my neighbor Ira's garage and stole 2 bottles of Chardonnay and another bottle of vodka, and I went down to my basement and I drank both bottles of the Chardonnay. The tears are running. Then I got dressed up as Luke Skywalker, and I mixed the vodka and some more cranberry into a giant Obi-Wan Kenobi mug and went out with the girls. They knew something was wrong with me, but they tried to have fun. He wipes again. I don't know when, but at some point I passed out in the wagon while the girls were up at someone's door. He sobs. They came back and tried to pull the wagon back to our house, but they're little girls, and I was too heavy. Sobs. They went to our neighbor Len's house to get help, and when they came back with Len and his wife, Ginny, they found that I had peed all over my Skywalker costume and all over the wagon. Sobs. Len tried to wake me, and when he did, I attacked him. You see, Len has a big, thick, blonde beard, and I was so drunk that I thought he was the man in the lion costume from 2 years earlier. Sobs. Oh, God. Sobs. Oh, God. He stops, wipes his face, takes a deep breath. The men spread around the room are speechless. He looks up. Len had to tie me up with a dog leash to control me, and my wife had to come home from New Jersey before Tina's bat mitzvah. He starts bawling. I disgraced myself, my daughters, my wife. There are several chuckles. I'm the laughingstock of the whole neighborhood. He completely breaks down, wailing, sobbing, holding his face in his hands. Several men start laughing. Lincoln looks at them, speaks. Shut up. The men laugh harder. More join in. The bald man looks up. Lincoln speaks. This is not funny. They laugh harder. More join in. The bald man is stunned. Lincoln speaks, his voice louder, his voice harder. This is not funny. The room erupts. The bald man stands and he runs, wailing, sobbing, and crying from the room. Lincoln steps in front of the empty chair. You people think that was funny? The men laugh. It wasn't. They begin to quiet down. That was a man spilling his heart to you, spilling his goddamn heart. There is quiet. Opening up and telling you about the worst moment of his life, the moment he hit bottom and knew he needed help. Silence. That's a hard thing to do, and he's a brave man for doing it, and he deserves to be given respect, not to be fucking laughed at. Lincoln shakes his head, lowers his voice. You think you're all hard asses because maybe you took harder drugs than him, or drank more than him, or maybe your bottom was lower than his.
But when I asked for a volunteer to talk about bottoming out, I didn't see any of you step up. You just sat there like scared little boys.
He points in the direction of the bald man's departure.
You should learn from that man, and you should learn from what he did up here today. He was brave, and he was open, and he was honest, and he made himself vulnerable to everyone in this room. That's what being here is all about, and that's the kind of attitude that is going to keep him sober.
He starts to walk out.
Think about it. Think long and hard.
He stares as he does.
Long and hard.
He leaves. There is complete silence. The men look at one another, ashamed and embarrassed, waiting for someone to speak. Leonard stands.
Lincoln's right, and we should apologize to the little guy, but I still think that story was fucking funny.
Everyone laughs. Leonard stands, looks at his watch.
It's lunchtime. I'm going to eat.
He leaves and the men stand and begin filing out and heading to the dining hall. I stand and I follow them and I get in a line and I get a tray of food. I sit down and I listen to Ed and Ted argue, and I laugh as Leonard eggs them on, and I finish, and I get up and I put my tray on the conveyor belt. I go to the lecture. A priest talks about different forms of confession. I don't like priests. Don't trust priests, and I don't listen to a single word of what he has to say. I sit and I stare at the floor and I think about the bald man. I wonder where he is and what he's thinking, and as I replay his story in my mind, it becomes more and more devastating. Although he wasn't on Skid Row or in a ghetto or in a crack house, and although he still has a job and a family and a life, he lost the most important thing a human being can lose, which was his dignity. I know a bit about the loss of dignity. I know that when you take away a man's dignity, there is a hole, a deep black hole filled with despair, humiliation, and self-hatred, filled with emptiness, shame, and disgrace, filled with loss and isolation and hell. It's a deep, dark, horrible fucking hole. And that hole is where people like me live our sad-ass, fucked-up, dignity-free, inhuman lives, and where we die, alone, miserable, wasted, and forgotten. The lecture ends, and I leave, and I go back to the unit, and I sit through an exercise on rational reaction therapy. Ken leads it, and explains that alcoholics and addicts tend to react irrationally in situations involving stress. Rational reaction therapy is a method of decision-making to counteract that irrational behavior. When you're in a situation, consider all options. Take your time. Stay calm. Choose the option that is the most healthy and productive. It is a very rational philosophy. After the exercise, there is another graduation ceremony. Three men I don't know are leaving. They have done their time, and they have worked their programs, and they are ready to face the outside world. They are happy as they receive their rocks and their medals. Two of them cry when they give their speeches. The ceremony ends, and everyone claps, and some of the men start playing cards, and some of them start watching television, and some of them get changed and go to the gym on the other side of the clinic. The graduates leave. I go to my room, and I put on Hank's jacket, and I go outside. There is no sun. The life that showed itself yesterday has retreated. The ground is cold and hard, the air oppressive, the sky black, the trees bent beneath the weight of frozen branches. I walk and I smoke and I find a trail, and I let the trail lead me. It is dark and quiet beneath the canopy of dense, heavy wood, and the only sound is that of my feet forging through piles of crackled yellow leaves. I listen to the leaves. I stare at the ground. I try to lose myself. I try to forget where I am and why I'm here. I try to forget about what lies in front of me. I try to forget about death, prison, and recovery. I try to forget that there is a world outside of that which is in my head. And I try to forget that there is a world within my head. I try to forget everything. The whole fucking mess. I walk, stare, try to lose, try to lose, try to lose.
The crack of leaves fades into a sharp, tumbling roll of small stones, and the stones lead me to a long, narrow lake, covered with delicate sheets of thin, fractured ice. I stare at the sheets. In the shallows beneath, packs of small fish dance. Solitary weeds lie still. Algae clings to whatever it can find. A shell sits lonely and silent, and I stop and I watch it. Somewhere within there is life. At some point, life will shed its shell and reemerge. I stare at the shell in the shallows beneath a delicate sheet of fractures. Life reemerging. I want to forget, but I can't. I walk again. Continue to try. Continue, continue. The shore drifts into a wide stretch of tall, dead, yellow grass, and my feet become silent on an artery of hard, black, packed dirt. As they carry me through the grass, I run my hands along the sharp, frozen tips of the grass, and they tickle me, and I laugh, and the sound of my laughter calms me. Forget, lose, forget, please, lose. It tickles me, and I laugh. The packed dirt graduates to bog, and I step onto an elevated walk of faded pine, embedded screws, and tall, firm rails. The deep stench of swamp seeps up, and through, too strong to be killed by the cold. As I walk, I lean over the rail, and I breathe in stench, and I stare across a murky brown desolation, dotted with rotting chunks of tree, turf, and prickly gray shrub. There is an island among the rot, a large round pile with monstrous protrusions like the arms of a witch. There is chatter beneath the pile, and a fat brown otter with a flat armored tail climbs atop, and he stares at me. Hey, fat otter. He stares at me. You want what I got? He stares at me. I'll give you everything. Stares at me. Give me your pile and give me your tail. Stares. And I'll give you the whole fucking mess. Stares. What do you think? He sits and he stares, seems to consider, and he disappears back under the pile. I wait for him to come back, but he doesn't. You're a smart otter. A smart fucking otter. I laugh and I let go of the rail and I continue to walk. The pine crescendos and it takes me down and leads me to a path of stone, and the stone rings another small lake. And I try to look through the ice, but there are no fractures, and the ice is too thick. If there is life, it is hidden beneath a cold, frozen shell. I think, and I forget, and my feet carry me through heavier wood. The air is black, and the leaves are thicker, and the crackle is hypnotic. And though my eyes are open, I don't see anything. I just walk. I come out of the wood and the darkness, but not out of my head. There is a brown grass hill ahead of me. I climb to the top, the view shows me the buildings, and the benches and the lake. It shows me moving shadows created by the lights of the bright, clean, uncomfortable halls. I sit down, and the brown grass is wet, and I'm not bothered by it. And my eyes drift to the screams coming from behind the dark, barred windows of the medical unit. The screams soak in, and they echo, echo, echo. And I lie back. And the jacket gets wet, and the back of my head gets wet, and I close my eyes, and I listen, and I think. I allow myself to feel completely, and the feeling brings lucid, linear streams of thought and image, and they run through and out and back, and through and out and back. They run through and out and back they run. Can't stop. Have to stop. Can't stop. Pain. Gutter. Priest. Fuck God. Her. Fuck her! Pipe, torch, bottle, can't stop. Pain, take it. Rage, murderous rage, uncontrollable rage. Sins unpardonable, places from which there is no return. Damage irreparable. Cry, fight. Mom, dad, brother, cry, fight, live, torch, pipe, bottle. Sick, sick, sick. Get better. Impossible. Stay. Impossible. Fuck God, fuck her, fuck you. Stay, live, fight, cry. Decision, decision, decision. Bring it. Take it, take it. decision.
The streams are lucid and clear, and they run back and through and back and through, and they meet and they lose, empty, forget, and there is something, something, something I hardly know, perfect calm, clarity, serenity, peace. My urges are gone. My heart is beating slow and steady. Everything I know and I am, and I have seen, felt, done, past, present, past, now, then, before now, seen, felt, done, hurt, felt, focus into a something beyond words, beyond, 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 and it speaks now and it says, stay, fight, live, take it, cry, cry, cry.
Sickness drags me from sleep, pushes me out of bed, throws me before my friend and my enemy, it throws me before the porcelain. It empties, racks, hurts, it won't let go of me. There are chunks of stomach, bile and remnants of last night's dinner. There is acid, snot and spit, there is blood, streams of blood. I get in the shower, and I turn up the heat, and I wash the sickness from my face and my body. It gathers around the drain, and I crush it with my feet, and I make it disappear. I'm sick of being sick. I want it to disappear. I crush it with my feet. I brush my teeth. The new ones are just like the old ones. I like them, and I'm happy to have them. A white scar is forming in place of the hole in my cheek, another reminder of the life I live. I don't even bother with my eyes. I get dressed and I make the coffee and I pour myself a cup and I drink it. It's strong, and I get sick again, so I take another shower, and I brush my teeth a second time. I don't even bother with my eyes. I change, and I get another cup of coffee, and I walk to breakfast, and I get some oatmeal, and I cover it with sugar. I sit down at a table with Leonard and Ed and Ted, and a short, thin black man. I have seen the black man before, though I can't place him. Leonard speaks. How you doing, kid? I'm all right. He motions to the black man. You meet Maddie yet? No. Maddie James. James Maddie. We reach across the table, shake hands. I say nice to meet you. He says nice to meet you, motherfucker. I look at him more closely. I speak. I know you from somewhere. He speaks. He has a high voice, talks very quickly. Where the fuck you know me from? I'm not sure. Where do you live? Minneapolis. That's not it. What's your last name? You ain't supposed to fucking ask me my last fucking name in this fucking place. It registers. I know where I know him. Your last name is Jackson. How the fuck you know that? I used to watch you on TV. You were the featherweight champion of the world. He smiles. I sure as fuck was. I smile. And they wouldn't ever interview you because you swear so much. They sure as fuck wouldn't, cock-sucking motherfucking TV motherfuckers. Everyone laughs, and breakfast gets pushed aside, and we sit, and we drink coffee, and we talk shit, and we laugh. Maddie is a wreck, a shell of the man he was 2 years ago, when he was one of the best boxers in the world. At the time, he held 2 championships, was rich and famous, married, and had 2 young boys. At a party celebrating one of his victories, he took a hit from a pipe he was told was full of pot, but was actually loaded with crack. He got hooked immediately, fought one more time and got destroyed, and he disappeared. It is strange to be sitting across from him. It is strange to imagine that the man I used to watch on TV is the man in front of me. At the height of his career, he was a fighting machine. He was fast, smart, strong, and unbeatable at his weight, 126 pounds. He was handsome, had a big smile, there wasn't an ounce of fat on his body, and he had dark, smooth, flawless skin. His confidence was supreme, and he entered and commanded the ring as if he owned it. There is nothing left. He is very small, 110 pounds at the most. His hair is tangled and nappy, his skin is covered with open sores, and his teeth are yellow, brown, and black. Though his confidence seems to be intact, I doubt he could find a boxing ring, much less command it, or render someone unconscious within it. I don't ask him about his wife or his kids because I don't want to know, and he probably doesn't want to tell me. The dining hall empties. We don't notice because of Maddie and Leonard and our laughter. When one of the janitors walks over and he tells us to leave, we walk to the lecture together, and Maddie talks and he swears and he makes us laugh. When we get to the lecture, we sit together, away from the rest of the men of our unit, and before the speaker begins, Leonard pulls out a deck of cards and we start playing poker. We don't bet, and except for Maddie swearing under his breath, we play silently, signaling each other with hands and our heads. The lecture ends and I say goodbye to my friends and I walk through the halls until I find the door that has Joanne's name on it. I knock. I hear her say, "Come in," and I open the door and step inside. She and Hank are sitting on the couch drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. Hank rises when he sees me, and he gives me a hug. "How you doing, kid?" We separate. "I'm good. Let me see those teeth." I smile. "They look nice." "I guess so. Was it worth it?" "I survived. I don't know how, but I guess you did." "It was worth it." He laughs, moves toward the door. "Come visit me in the livery sometime." "Where's the livery?" "It's the van, sitting in front of the entrance." I laugh. He reaches for the door. "You don't have to leave. You two probably need to be alone. I'd like you to stay." He stops, looks at me, sits next to Joanne. I sit in a chair across from them. Joanne speaks. "What can I help you with?" "I've been thinking about our conversation yesterday."
"What have you been thinking?"
"I'm going to stay here for a while. See what happens."
"A while?"
"I'm not making any promises." She smiles.
"I think that's a good start."
"We'll see." They both smile.
Joanne speaks. "What sparked this?"
"I don't know. Must have been something. I don't want to talk about it."
"Why?"
"Because I don't."
"Because it makes you feel vulnerable."
"Probably."
"And you don't like that, do you?"
I shake my head.
"No."
"If you're going to get better, you should get used to it."
"You're probably right.
Hank and I aren't going to hurt you."
"I know."
"Try it.
Be vulnerable."
I look at them, take a deep breath. I speak. "I saw a man cry yesterday. I've seen men cry before, but I usually think it's because they're weak or pathetic. The man who cried yesterday cried because he was strong, and I admired his strength. I know people might think I'm strong or tough, but I'm really not. I'm a sheep in wolf's clothing." I take another breath. "So I was thinking about that, and I was out walking around, and I was trying to forget this place, and I was trying to forget all the shit I've gotten myself into, and I laid down in the grass, and I felt calm, very calm, and I decided to stay for a while."
"How'd it feel?"
"Just like I said, calm."
"You had what is called a moment of clarity.
That one of your AA terms?"
"Yes."
"Then, no, I didn't have a moment of clarity. I just felt calm." They both laugh. Joanne speaks.
"That wasn't so hard, was it?"
"Guess not."
"That's all you have to do, and you'll get better. Be honest. Be vulnerable. Talk about it."
"I think it's going to be a bit more complicated than that."
"A bit, but not really."
"We'll see." There is a moment of silence. I stand.
"I gotta go. I just thought I'd come by and tell you what I decided."
Joanne speaks.
"We're glad you did."
I move to the door.
"I'll see you soon."
They say goodbye, and I walk out and back through the halls to the unit. I sit down on the floor with the rest of the men, and I watch the end of a video. The video is about an athlete who had a drinking problem and quit drinking using the 12 steps, and is now happy, well-adjusted, and serene. As he speaks, he is sitting in his office, and there are pictures hanging behind him in his glory days as an athlete, and everything is perfect, and everything is inspirational. It's a lot like an after-school special, and even though I'm going to try to keep an open mind while I'm here, I think the thing is fucking stupid, and I wonder if keeping an open mind at this place is the same thing as having an empty mind. Open mind, empty mind. This fucking stupid video isn't going to convince me to do anything. No fucking way. The video ends and everyone claps except for me. I boo, and I get a bunch of dirty looks. The looks make me laugh, and I get more dirty looks for laughing, which makes me laugh more. Someone I don't know asks me what's so funny, and I tell him the video, and he tells me to grow up, and I tell him that I'm not going to pretend that stupid shit is anything more than stupid shit, and he walks away, shaking his head. Open mind, empty mind. I wonder if they're the same thing. I go to lunch, and I get a tray and some food, and I eat with Ed and Ted and Maddie and Leonard. Maddie and Leonard do all the talking, and the rest of us do the laughing. By the time we're finished, our table is filled with men who have come over to hear Maddie and Leonard. After lunch, there is a lecture, but I don't pay any attention to it. After the lecture, Ken asks if he can see me in his office. I follow him through the halls, and when we get to his office, I sit down in a chair across from him. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Have you thought about what we talked about last time you were here?
I don't remember what that was.
Are you ready to do anything and everything it takes to get sober and stay sober?
Yeah, I thought about it.
Do you have an answer?
No.
Do you have an answer?
No.
Do you have an answer? Staring at me and asking the same goddamn question over and over isn't going to get us anywhere. He stares.
Do you have an answer?
I laugh.
No.
Hopefully, at some point you will.
We'll see.
He sighs and shakes his head, looks at the papers on his desk. I want to start getting into the meat of your program.
All right.
He pulls out what looks like a children's coloring book, and he hands it to me.
We'll start with this.
I look at the book.
What's this?
It's a first step workbook. I laugh.
It's a fucking coloring book.
It's simple, yes, but we think the simplest approach is the best.
You want me to do a coloring book?
Yes. I laugh.
You got a box of Crayolas I can borrow?
There's some on the unit.
I hope nobody took the Razzle Dazzle Rose.
What's that?
My favorite crayon color. They have it in the 64 box.
You through? You tired of me?
I'm tired of your jokes.
You don't think they're funny?
No.
I'll stop for a while.
Good.
When's my deadline?
2 days.
Got it. There's also a goal board hanging on the upper level. I want you to put your name on it and put down a life goal that you have and hope to achieve through sobriety.
Okay.
You have any ideas?
New set of teeth every year.
Not funny.
Become president of the United States.
You'll be lucky to vote with your record.
Make mine the prettiest first step coloring book ever?
You through?
You tired of me?
Put down a goal. Don't make a joke out of it.
I'll do my best.
I also think a change of scenery might be good for you, so this afternoon I'm going to switch your room assignment.
To where?
To a two-man room. Warren and John are leaving later today, and I think it would be better to fill that room with newer arrivals.
I'd like that.
I'll make the switch and tell you the room number later.
Cool.
You seem better, and you seem to be making headway, but you need to take what we are doing in here a bit more seriously. We ask for progress, not perfection. Just do your best.
I'll try.
Come find me when you finish the book. I'd like to go over it with you.
Okay.
I stand and I leave, and I walk back to the unit. I look for John and Warren, and I don't see them, so I go to my room and I walk in. John is standing by his window, and Warren is packing. I sit down on my bed. "Hi." Warren speaks. "Hi." John stares out the window. "I hear you're leaving today." Warren speaks. "Yes, I am." "You excited?" "Yes, but I'm also nervous. I've been a drinker all my life, and it's going to be tough not having a nice strong scotch at the end of each day. Or maybe six nice scotches."
"You're better without it."
"You're certainly right about that." I stand, walk over to him. He stops packing.
"Good luck, Warren."
I offer my hand. He takes it.
"Thanks, James."
We shake, strong and firm. I speak. "I've really appreciated how cool you've been to me." "It's been a pleasure, James, and I'd do it again." We let go, and I walk over to John's area. John's bags are packed, and they're sitting on his bed. He's still standing by the window, staring out at gray nothing. "John?" He turns around. There are tears on his face.
"Hi, James."
"What's wrong?"
"I'm scared."
"Come here." He steps over. I point to the bed.
"Sit."
He sits down on his bed, looks like a fragile little boy. I sit next to him.
"Why are you scared, John?"
"Because I know I'm not better."
"Why do you think that?"
"Because I know it in my heart."
"Then why don't you stay until you feel like you're better?"
"Because I know it won't do any good."
"Why do you think that?"
"Because I'll never be any better. I'll never be any more normal, and I'll never make the pain go away. Never, ever, ever."
"You can't think like that, John."
"You do."
"I'm trying not to anymore."
"How?"
"I don't know how. I'm just trying."
He looks at me, looks down at the bed, and he bursts out crying.
"I feel safe here. Nobody can do anything to me, and I can't do anything to myself."
He looks up at me, a fragile little boy.
"Once I leave here, I know I'm going to do something stupid, and I know I'm going to end up back in jail, and I know what's going to happen to me there, and I don't want that to happen anymore."
I take one of his hands, hold it. Don't know what to say. He cries, 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 sobbing, tears running down his face, his chest up and down, heavily up and down. I let go of his hand and I put my arms around him and I hug him, and he cries and there is nothing I can say. He stops crying, and he settles and I let go of him and he wipes his face.
"I'm sorry."
"Don't be sorry, John. There's nothing wrong with crying."
"I cry a lot."
"I know. I admire that about you."
"You do?"
"Yeah, I do. I think men who can cry are strong men."
"You think I'm strong?"
"I think you're stronger than you know."
"Thanks, James."
He wipes his face again.
"I'm gonna miss it here."
"We'll miss you."
"Really?"
"Yeah."
"You're not lying?"
"No, I'm not lying." He looks at me, reaches into one of his bags, and he pulls out a pen and a card.
"Will you do something for me, James?"
"Of course." He starts writing on the card.
"When you get out of here, will you call my daughter?"
"Not this again, John."
"No, not that."
He holds out the card.
"Will you call her and tell her that I tried real hard this time, as hard as I could, and that I wish I was more to her, and that I'm not as bad a man as everyone tells her I am?"
I take the card, look at John.
"I'd be honored, John. And if you're ever in the same place as her, maybe you could take her out to dinner or something, and..."
He pauses, starts to cry, holds it back.
"And just be nice to her. And..."
He can't hold it. He starts to cry, like a fragile little boy.
"And tell her I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
I reach out and I hug him. And I hold him, and I let him cry, 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 and he pushes me away. And he asks me to leave him alone, and as I walk out of the room, I look toward him, and his head is buried in his pillow, and I can hear him sobbing and wailing and saying the word, "No, no, no." I leave him to himself and to his future. And as I walk into the unit, I make sure the card is deep and safe in my pocket. I will make that call when I leave here. I will make that call. And I will tell that girl that her father was a good man. She may not believe me, and there may not be anything to say that would change her mind, but I will tell her. The unit is crowded, and the men are waiting for John and Warren and for their graduation ceremony. I don't want to see it or participate in it, and I have said my goodbyes to them, so I start walking. Same as yesterday, I just want to forget. There is no forgetting today. I know that as soon as I enter the wood. The fury takes over. It envelops every emotion, every feeling, every thought that I have. I can't deal with emotions, feelings, thoughts, so I let the fury deal with them. It consumes them. The sadness I feel turns to rage, the calm to a desperate need. I want to destroy everything I see. That which I can't destroy, I want to ingest. With each step that I take, it grows. Rage and need, rage and need, rage, need. I want a drink. I want 50 drinks. I want a bottle of the purest, strongest, most destructive, most poisonous alcohol on earth. I want 50 bottles of it. I want crack, dirty and yellow and filled with formaldehyde. I want a pile of powder meth, 500 hits of acid, a garbage bag filled with mushrooms, a tube of glue bigger than a truck, a pool of gas large enough to drown in. I want something, anything, whatever, however, as much as I can. Want, need. I want, need enough to kill, annihilate, make me lose, make me forget, dull the motherfucking pain, give me the darkest darkness, the blackest blackness, the deepest, 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 most horrible fucking hole. God damn it to fucking hell, give it to me, put me in the fucking hole. I leave the trail, force my way through heavy frozen wood. I am shaking, and my heart is racing, and I am clenching my fist, and I am clenching my jaw. My feet are snapping twigs and crushing infant sapling trees. My arms are removing whatever stands in front of me. The sharp sounds of destruction, a snap, crack, incense me, enrage me, make me want to break more, destroy more, ruin everything. I want to ruin everything everywhere. I want to fucking ruin. I break through a stand of thick evergreen and into a small, tight, circular clearing. I stop walking, forging, pushing, fighting, and I close my eyes. And I take a deep breath, and I hope that the breath will calm me, but it doesn't. So I take another, and it doesn't. Another doesn't, another doesn't, another doesn't. I want to be calm, but there is no calm for me. How I am here. How I have arrived in this place, at this moment, on this day, with this feeling, history, future, problems, life. This horrible, fucked-up, good-for-nothing waste of a life. How? 15 minutes ago, I was holding a lifelong criminal and cocaine addict who spent his childhood with his father's dick in his mouth as he cried because he was scared to go back into the world. I ate my lunch with some kind of menacing middle-aged movie star look-alike and a 3-strike fugitive and a steel worker with torn-out hair plugs and a 110-pound ghost who used to be the champion of the world. I was given a coloring book and told it would help make me better. I watched some judge's stupid fucking video, and I was told it would help make me better. I got sick, just like I do every other fucking day, and I am not getting better. I am 23 years old, and I've been an alcoholic for a decade, and a drug addict and criminal for almost as long, and I'm wanted in 3 states, and I'm in a hospital in the middle of Minnesota, and I wanted to drink, and I want to do some drugs, and I can't control myself. I'm 23! I breathe, and I shake, and I can feel it coming, and rage, and need, and confusion, regret, horror, shame, and hatred fuse into a perfect fury. A great and beautiful and terrible and perfect fury, the fury, and I can't stop the fury or control the fury. I can only let the fury come. Let it motherfucking come! The fury has come. I see a tree and I go after it, screaming, punching, kicking, clawing, tearing, ripping, dragging, pulling, wrecking, punching, screaming, punching, screaming, punching, screaming. It is a small tree, a small pine tree, small enough that I can destroy it. And I rip the branches from its trunk, and I tear them to pieces one by one. I rip them, and I tear them, and I throw them to the ground, and I stomp them, stomp them, stomp them. And when there are no more branches, I hear a voice, and I attack the trunk, and it's thin, and I break it in half. And I hear a voice, and I ignore it. And I throw the broken trunk on top of the branches, and one half of it is still in the ground. I hear a voice, and I want it out of the fucking ground, and I grab it, and pull, 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 and it doesn't budge not an inch. I hear a voice, and I ignore, and I pull, scream, pull, and it doesn't budge this fucking tree. I want to destroy it, and I let go of it, and there is a voice I ignore. I start kicking, 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 and the voice says, stop, 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 stop! I turn around. Long black hair and deep, clean blue eyes and skin pale white and lips blood red. She's small and thin and worn and damaged. She is standing there. What are you doing here?
I was taking a walk and I saw you and I followed you.
What do you want?
I want you to stop.
I breathe hard, stare hard, tense and coiled. There is still more tree for me to destroy. I want that fucking tree.
She smiles and she steps toward me. Toward me, and she opens her arms, and I'm breathing hard, staring hard, tense, and coiled. She puts her arms around me with one hand on the back of my head, and she pulls me into her arms, and she holds me, and she speaks. It's okay. I breathe hard, close my eyes, let myself be held. It's okay.
Her voice calms me, and her arms warm me, and her smell lightens me, and I can feel her heartbeat, and my heart slows, and I stop shaking, and the fury melts into her safety, and she holds me, and she says, okay, okay, okay. Something else comes, and it makes me feel weak and scared and fragile, and I don't want to be hurt, and this feeling is the feeling I have when I know I can be hurt, and hurt deeper and more terribly than anything physical, and I always fight it and control it and stop it, but her voice calms me, and her arms warm me, and her smell lightens me, and I can feel her heartbeat, and if she let me go right now, I would fall. And the need and confusion and fear and regret and horror and shame and weakness and fragility are exposed to the soft strength of her open arms and her simple word, okay. And I start to cry. I start to cry. I start to cry. It comes in waves. The waves roll deep and from deep, the deep within me, and I hold her, and she holds me tighter, and I let her, and I let it, and I let this, and I have not felt this way, this vulnerability, or allowed myself to feel this way, this vulnerability, since I was 10 years old. And I don't know why I haven't. And I don't know why I am now. And I only know that I am. And that it is scary, terrifying, frightening, worse and better than anything I have ever felt, crying in her arms, just crying in her arms, just crying. She guides me to the ground. But she doesn't let me go. The gates are open, and 13 years of addiction, violence, hell, and their accompaniments are manifesting themselves in dense tears and heavy sobs, and a shortness of breath, and a profound sense of loss. The loss inhabits, fills, and overwhelms me. It is the loss of a childhood, of being a teenager, of normalcy, of happiness, of love, of trust, of reason, of God, of family, of friends, of future, of potential, of dignity, of humanity, of sanity, of myself, of everything, everything, everything. I lost everything. And I am lost, reduced to a mass of mourning, sadness, grief, anguish, and heartache. I am lost. I have lost. Everything. Everything. It's wet, and Lily cradles me like a broken child. My face and her shoulder and her shirt and her hair are wet with my tears. I slow down, and I start to breathe slowly and deeply. And her hair smells clean, and I open my eyes because I want to see it, and it is all that I can see. It is jet black, almost blue, and radiant with moisture. I want to touch it, and I reach with one of my hands, and I run my hand from the crown along her neck and her back to the base of her rib, and it is a thin, perfect sheer, and I let it slowly drop from the tips of my fingers, and when it is gone, I miss it. I do it again and again, and she lets me do it. And she doesn't speak, she just cradles me because I am broken. I am broken. Broken. There is noise and voices, and Lily pulls me in tighter and tighter, and I pull her in tighter and tighter, and I can feel her heart beating, and I know she can feel my heart beating, and they are speaking, our hearts are speaking a language wordless, old, unknowable, and true. And we're pulling and holding, and the noise is closer, and the voice is louder, and Lily whispers, "You're okay, you're okay, you're okay." And she lets me go, and I let her go, and she stands, and I stay, and she stares down at me. "I have to go." I stare at her. "I'll call you later." I stare at her. "Bye." I stare at her and she backs away toward the far edge of our clearing. When she reaches the edge, she turns around and she disappears through evergreen thick. And I hear her step settling and her step is gentle. And I hear her voice intermingle and her voice is gentle. And I sit and I breathe and I sit and I stare. I am alone, lost, and broken. I stare at the evergreen thick. Alone, lost, broken. The sun is falling. And the cold is running, and the night is descending, and I'm tired, spent, and completely empty. I force myself to stand, and I make my way through the trees until I pick up a trail, and then I let the trail lead me. My feet are heavy, my body is tired, and my heart is beating slow, slow, slow. The walk is only a couple hundred yards, but it seems across the earth. It takes all my strength to open the door. I step inside and I walk through the unit and I go to my room. As I enter, I see that all of my things, my new beautiful things, have been stacked on a chair near my bed. I flare momentarily until I notice a letter sitting on top of my clothes. I reach for it and I open it and I read it, and it is from Ken. And it says, "Per our earlier conversation, you are being moved to a new room," and it has the room number. I pick up my clothes and my books. They are my only belongings in the world, and I leave. I walk through the halls surrounding the unit, looking for my new room. I find the room and the door is closed, and my arms are full, so I kick the door open with one of my feet. I walk inside. The room is smaller than the other room, but otherwise identical. There are two beds and a bathroom off to the side. There is a middle-aged black man lying on one of the beds. I have never seen him before. He looks at me and he speaks. "Most people knock before entering a room." He has a deep, slow, southern accent. "I didn't know anyone was here." I walk to the empty bed. "You could have knocked anyway." I sit down. "Sorry." I start putting my stuff away. "Are you living here?"
"Yeah."
"What's your name?"
"James."
"Hello, James. My name's Miles."
"Like Miles Davis?"
"Exactly like Miles Davis."
"Exactly?"
"Yes."
"Your name is Miles Davis?"
"Yes, it is." I laugh.
"You play the trumpet?"
"No, I play the clarinet." He motions toward a black case sitting at the foot of his bed. "I played the trumpet when I was younger, but when the other Miles got famous, I quit. It was a bit too much."
"Where are you from?"
"New Orleans."
"Where are you from?" I live in North Carolina.
Which part?
Wilmington.
Do you like Wilmington?
It's nice, but I don't really give a shit.
He laughs.
What do you do down in New Orleans?
I'm a judge.
What do you judge?
I'm a judge in the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals.
That's heavy.
He shrugs.
It is what it is.
You put people away?
I did when I worked in the criminal court, but I don't anymore.
What was that like?
It's hard putting away a man. There's nothing good waiting for him in jail, even if he does deserve it.
I nod.
What do you do?
I get in trouble.
He laughs.
What kind of trouble?
All kinds.
You in trouble now?
Wouldn't be here if I wasn't.
He laughs again.
Are you in any other trouble?
Can I plead the fifth?
If you would like.
I would.
He looks at his watch.
Have you eaten supper yet?
No.
Would you like to eat with me?
I stand.
Let's go.
He stands and we leave the room. We walk through the halls to the cafeteria, and we get in line and we get some food. When we sit down at a table, I find out that Miles is an alcoholic, and that he's married, and he has two children, and he arrived here this afternoon. He speaks quietly and methodically, and he chooses his words carefully, and he says as much with his hands and his eyes and the motions of his head as he does with words themselves. When I speak, he listens carefully, softly interjecting with a nod or a chuckle or quiet word of validation. He is immediately a friend, which is strange to me. I have always hated cops and judges or authority figures of any kind, and the last place I would have ever thought I would befriend one would be in a treatment center. After a few minutes, we are joined by Leonard and Maddie and Ed and Ted. It is a typical meal with them. They laugh, make fun of one another, tell stories about their pasts, talk shit about the clinic's other patients. Aside from Miles, there are four new men on our unit, and Leonard and Maddie and Ed and Ted size them up, talk about which ones they like and which ones they don't like, and make plans to fuck with them. There is one, a short, fat man named Bobby, whom they seem to harbor a particular dislike for, though I don't know why. I do know that I'm glad I'm not him. We finish eating and we walk as a group to the lecture. We sit as a group in the seats. I sit on the aisle and I watch for Lily. When she walks in, my heart jumps and my hands shake, and me myself inside settles, it settles, and those things for which there are no words ignite, and they start firing, firing, firing. I knew I would be affected when I saw her, but I didn't know this. And I don't know this, and I'm surprised, and the surprise makes me nervous, and I'm usually not nervous. Usually I'm just pissed. I'm not pissed right now. They have ignited, and they are firing. A man walks out on stage, and everyone starts clapping. I recognize the man as a famous rock star who was once a patient here. He holds his arms up in triumph, and he smiles and he bows, and his black leather is shining, and his long, greasy black hair is hanging, and his patterned silk shirt is flowing, and his large, round, silver earrings are dangling, and everyone is dazzled. He motions for quiet, and the clapping stops, and he starts theatrically pacing back and forth across the stage, back and forth. He stops and he stares at the ceiling for a moment, as if there's something up there besides the ceiling panels, and he looks back and he starts speaking in a deep, serious voice. His first words are, "When I had my first hit single and I got famous, I started to party really fucking hard." From there, he launches into a detailed accounting of his career. He talks about the number of records sold and the number of women slept with and the number of awards won. He talks about living on the road, and he says, "It ain't easy, man, even if you are staying at the Four Seasons." He talks about the rigors of recording an album, and he talks about the pressures of being a star. He talks about what he calls the national obsession with his lips and his hair,
and he talks about melodic qualities of his voice. After a while, after far too long a while, he talks about drinking and drugs. When he talks of heroin, he taps the bend of his elbow with two fingers. When he talks of coke, he sniffs. Booze, he makes a motion like he has a bottle. Pills, as if he's tossing them in. He claims that at the height of his use, he would do $5,000 of cocaine and heroin a day, mixed with 4 to 5 fifths of booze a night, and up to 40 pills of Valium to sleep. He says this with complete sincerity and with the utmost seriousness. I am tired, and I am spent. I am nervous, and I am happy. I am calm. Were I in my normal frame of mind, I would stand up, point my finger, scream, "Fraud!" and chase this chump motherfucker down and give him a beating. Were I in my normal frame of mind, after I gave him his beating, I would make him come back here and apologize to everyone for wasting their precious time. After the apology, I would tell him that if I ever heard of him spewing his bullshit fantasies in public again, I would cut off his precious hair, scar his precious lips, and take all of his goddamn gold records and shove them straight up his ass. I don't like this man. I don't like what he has to say or how he's saying it. I don't believe him, and his rock star status isn't enough to make me buy the shit he's trying to sell. $4,000 to $5,000 a day of anything is enough to kill a person several times over. 5 bottles of strong liquor over the course of a night would render the strongest human on earth comatose. 40 volumes to sleep, and he'd take a fucking nap from which he'd never return. He'd never return. And maybe that would be best. An addict is an addict. It doesn't matter whether the addict is white, black, yellow, or green, rich or poor, or somewhere in the middle, the most famous person on the planet, or the most unknown. It doesn't matter whether the addiction is drugs, alcohol, crime, sex, shopping, food, gambling, television, or the fucking Flintstones. The life of the addict is always the same. There is no excitement, no glamour, no fun. There are no good times. There is no joy. There is no happiness. There is no future and no escape. There is only an obsession, an all-encompassing, fully enveloping, completely overwhelming obsession. To make light of it, brag about it, or revel in the mock glory of it is not in any way, shape, or form related to its truth. And that is all that matters, the truth. That this man is standing in front of me and everyone else in this room lying to us is heresy. The truth is all that matters. This is fucking heresy. The lecture ends, and there is wild applause and enthusiastic cheers, and the lips, hair, leather, and silk on the stage is smiling and waving and glowing and blowing kisses to his adoring fans. I am tired. I am spent. I am nervous, and I am happy, and I am calm. Were I in my normal frame of mind, I'd be sick to my stomach. I hear Leonard mumbling, and I ask him what he just said, and he laughs, and tells me that he's thinking of sending a few of his associates to have a talk with the lips about an attitude adjustment. I laugh, and I tell him it would be a beautiful thing. Bless you, Leonard, it would be a beautiful fucking thing. We stand, and we start to file out, and before I leave, I turn to get a glimpse of Lily, but I can't see her. And I don't want to make my intentions obvious, so I turn back, and I keep walking.